everybody, no more sleeping in bed. No more backward thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There is so much hatred, war and poverty. Oh.
Wake up, everybody, and thanks for joining us. Conversations at the Cafe, the Eclectic Cafe, that is. Good morning. I'm Bonnie Grice, and it's 9:13. We've got 70 degrees outside our studios. It's going to be warm and humid and stormy today. Stormy weather upon us. We've got some heavy weather developing. Showers a little bit later on this morning and this afternoon. We could see rain up to an inch, and we've got thunderstorms, a possibility for later tonight as well. Highs today in the mid-70s, chance of rain near 100%. And we could have a shower or two tomorrow morning as well before it clears out tomorrow night. And then by Thursday, back to sunshine, beautiful weather, of course, and highs in the 70s. We need the rain, though. We need the rain and look forward to that. And we look forward, as always, to chatting up our guests this morning. It's our way of keeping you informed each day on what's happening in our world here on the East End and across the shores of Southern Connecticut. And that is our listening area, proudly so. And we are WPPB Peconic Public Broadcasting. Check us out online, listener-supported radio. You can show your support there as well, peconicpublicbroadcasting.org. And we welcome back our engineer. He is extraordinaire, Mr. Kyle Lynch. Thanks, Kyle. Welcome back. We are going to talk later on with the Harvest East End folks, because Harvest East End occurred a couple of weeks ago, but the harvest continues, as you well know. They're all out in the fields right now harvesting. But also there is this series of 10-mile dinners that's being presented by Harvest East End and to help support those same charities. So we'll talk a little bit more later on with Roman Roth and company about these 10-mile dinners that are happening across the East End. But in the meantime, there's also a very special show happening at the Watermill Museum. And leave it to the Watermill Museum and Gallery on Old Mill Road in Watermill. This is a vintage New York saltwater fishing baits and lures show, along with a show of antique working decoy collectibles. Joining us live in the studio are the two gentlemen involved in both, Bob Jones, Bob Lear. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Bonnie.
Nice to see you and to meet you. And come on. What can we say? Ann Lombardo, who is, you know, like the driving engine behind the Watermill Museum, right, guys?
Oh, I don't know.
Good morning, Ann.
I just follow my board around. Good
you
morning.
Just follow
good morning.
Your board, right?
A little more than that.
Right? Oh, yeah, and Bob Lear, you've been involved with the Watermill Museum for how long now?
Oh, probably 15, possibly 15 years, yes.
15 years, yes. Yeah. What got you involved initially?
I lived in Watermill. We've been members of the Watermill Museum for a number of years, and then I also came on the board, and it's a very active group, and I enjoy participating.
How big is the board, Ann? Are there a lot of people?
I'm going to say between 15 and 20 in any given month, year.
And very, very active.
Very active, and what's most special about it is all volunteer. We run a small to medium-sized museum with lots of programs, all volunteer. I mean, how amazing is that? We only pay two people in our whole place. One is the one who sits there and is there all day long, and the other is our money person.
And describe this Watermill Museum, just real quick. I mean, it is an actual working watermill, right?
Yes, it's a water-powered grist mill, which dates back to 1644. And actually, it is the reason that Watermill is called Watermill, because of this grist mill. And these early settlers that came wouldn't have been able to survive without a mill, because they had to be able to mill their grain to be able to, you know, make food for themselves. So It's got local history exhibits that are really, really all about watermill. So we've got the grinding of the grain, the actual wheel that runs. We've got the building itself, which is amazing, with all new LED green lighting. Amazing.
Really?
Yep. And we also have lots of local historical exhibits, like a fin fishing exhibit, ice harvesting exhibit, and more.
And so this, actually, you had, I think, the Fishing Baits and Lure Show last year, you mentioned?
We did. We had Bob Jones with the Fishing Baits and Lure Show. We just gave it a try, and it was so successful. We had, again, thanks to all the media locally, we had great coverage. Bob Lear's been running his antique decoy collectible show for many years, but took a few years off recently. So now we're bringing them both back together, right?
Do they belong together, would you say, guys, Bob?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
In what ways, do you think?
Well, I know myself. I don't collect the collectible birds or the decoys, but I go to their shows because I appreciate the history of it and I appreciate the art of it. And it's just beautiful.
Mm.
It's something that it's very hard to describe. It's something you feel in your stomach that, you know, you love it.
Yeah. And Bob, is that what got you involved?
Yes, I'm a member of the Long Island Decoy Collectors Association, as well as the treasurer. I've been a member of that organization for some 20 years. We have an annual show in March.
Where is that?
That's in, Hop-Hog?
Hop-Hog.
Yeah.
Hop-Hog, Long Island, yes.
Bob Jones has attended that. And we have an extensive following. We have as many as 1,000 people attending that event. It's a core of decoy collectors.
Any decoy carvers involved?
Yes, more and more contemporary decoys are coming in.
But do you collect the historical ones?
I mainly collect what's considered antique collectible decoys, which range from probably 1850, maybe to 1940, in that range.
When did you start collecting?
I always admired old decoys, and I, for years when I was a kid, I'd set them aside, and I didn't use them, and I realized one day I was a collector when I began purchasing them and attending shows. Early this year, I went to an auction in Chicago.
Really?
Which was large. I go to Easton, Maryland, and Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
So this is,
they have shows.
It's all across the country, though.
Yes.
I mean, this is, what is the appeal?
They're an art form. Decoys are an art form. They've been described, and recently two decoys went to auction and sold for $1 million.
$1 million?
Yes.
When did they date from?
Probably turn of the century, 1880, 1890. Whoa. in that period of time.
And when did people first start making decoys?
At that time, early 1800s. Shorebirds were very popular. They were shot actually for the food market as well as ducks. And in 1918, they banned all shooting of migratory waterfowl.
Mm.
So that was probably the end of the era of carving shorebird decoys.
So that's why they're so rare, I guess, because they stopped making them?
They become collectible, yes.
But now people are making decoys, but not for use?
Yes, they make contemporary decoys, which are very attractive, appealing, and a lot of people purchase them and have a collection of contemporary decoys.
Now, Bob Jones, you have a collection of lures and baits. What's the difference, first of all, between the two?
It's the same thing, actually. It's back in the day, right after World War II, in the early 50s, which are the lures that I focus on, they were called baits. And nowadays they call them lures, so I use both terms so people understand what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And nowadays people refer to bait as something like a worm or a piece of squid, maybe. But back then they called the lures the baits.
And these are very colorful, first of all.
They're very colorful. The ones that I collect and the ones that I'm going to be displaying at the Watermill Museum are all from the New York City area, and because I personally feel that they were the most talented guys, and I'm a little prejudiced. I'm a New Yorker, and so I'm kind of prejudiced. But there were areas in New Jersey and areas in New England that had the same type of thing going on at the time. Men came back from World War II. A lot of them weren't sleeping. A lot of them didn't have a lot of money, and going out and catching striped bass was a way of supplementing their income, or getting rid of their sleepless nights, And I started appreciating it about 10 years ago. I consider myself a collector. Prior to that, I was an accumulator.
What's the difference? It's the amount in your collection?
Well, I had about 800 lures about 10 years ago, and I started getting attached to some of them where I wouldn't fish them anymore. Oh. And then I realized I was just a collector.
What about you, Bob Lear? When did you change from accumulator to collector?
Very similar.
Yeah, yeah.
You would find a decoy that you realize it was old. And to preserve it, you would set it aside, not use it. And then one day you would see it as a collectible item. And when you really get into collecting decoys, you go out and buy everything you see. And then you sort of refine your collection and sell it off and refine it. And I collect right now primarily Long Island decoys. I have a lot of Long Island cork decoys, which were very popular.
They're cork, but what are they generally made of? Is it wood?
Yeah. Yes, wood. But on Long Island, early days, particularly after World War I, there was a lot of natural cork available from life vests, and they made two-piece cork decoys. I find them quite appealing. They're probably just only popular on Long Island.
So do people use decoys anymore? I know duck hunting is okay, right?
Duck hunting is still popular. Most all decoys now have gone to plastic.
Plastic?
Yes. And they're appealing. They decoy ducks, and they're painted.
Do they actually work?
Yes. Oh, yes.
They really do. So the decoys sit out.
The ducks aren't too smart. The
but really, they that's the whole point, obviously, in starting this whole industry, right? Is to lure the ducks to
lure
where,
the
or the birds,
yes.
You know, to where you want them to be, right?
Yes.
What is the oldest decoy that you own in your collection?
Oh, probably 1870, 1880.
And what is it of?
It's a shorebird. And it's a Paul Foster from Hampton Bays.
Wow, so from Hampton Bays.
And I found that, I purchased it from a fellow in Chicago.
So, like, are you online and there are, like, decoy websites?
www.decoys.com
or something?
A lot of clubs and organizations and dealers have websites,
right.
And have links.
And how about for lures and baits for fishing?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we have a club that I'm one of the founding members of. It's the Saltwater Lure Collectors Club. Our website is www.swlcc.com.
Wow.
And we have members all up and down the East Coast. We even have some members out in Washington and California. Anywhere where there's salt water and where there's a possibility of collecting striped bass, these lures are accumulated and collected.
So that's your focus. Salt water, striped bass.
Exactly.
The ever-elusive striped bass.
The ever-elusive striped bass.
There have been so many stories written about this creature, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Have you caught?
Oh, yes, I've caught a number of them.
Okay,
yes.
A number.
Wait, Bob is being very modest. Bob is a serious surf caster. You'll find him out in Montauk climbing on the rocks for years. How many years?
How many years, Bob?
Oh, I've been doing it for about 40 years, I guess.
Really?
Yes.
And you're from New York originally, but...
Yes, I'm from
New York.
You've
been out in the East End?
My license plate on my truck outside is Jones Beach, and that's because when I was younger, I used to own the Jones Beach jetty, and I caught many big fish out there.
Are
many
you related to Jones of Jones Beach?
No, I'm afraid not.
No.
I'm afraid not. I'm from the poorer side of the Jones clan.
Yes, right. But so you've been fishing since what?
I've been fishing since I was a boy. I used to fish with my brother, and we would bring it home. I'm one of ten. So my mother would cook whatever we caught.
Oh, my God.
And we would fish saltwater fish in the morning and maybe go get a couple of eels in the afternoon or a couple of bass out of a pond. And my mother would fry it all up in bacon grease, and we would eat it.
So you love fish, too,
oh,
right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Do you respect them as well?
Absolutely. I maybe keep one fish a year, and that's generally for a party.
Really?
Yeah.
And what's the biggest you've caught?
I've caught some in the high 40s. I might have broken the 50-pound mark. I didn't weigh. I don't usually keep them, so if I don't have a scale, I don't weigh them. But last year I weighed a 47.5 pounder.
Nice.
The best this year was about 24 pounds. But I still have a bit of season to go, so I might beat that.
Would weather like today be worth it to fish or not?
Yeah, right now, right now would probably be
right now.
Very, very good.
So
yes.
I've caught you during your fishing time.
Exactly. Right before a storm, it sometimes gets very, very dirty.
How about during? Have you ever fished during a storm?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. But sometimes the water gets very dirty, and out in Montauk, it can really beat you up.
Did you really? Did you know Percy Heath?
Oh, absolutely, sure. I know his son also.
Yes, right. Yeah. Does his son go out and fish?
Oh, yeah.
As well,
his son's
one
of the best fishermen in Montauk. And the whole family fishes, you know.
Yeah, he used to stop by all the time. Of course, one of the founders of the Modern Jazz Quartet. But I think more people knew him as a fisherman out here, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we were both in the Farragut Striper Club. He was an old Farragut Striper Club from Brooklyn member. And, you know, we were members of the club. And he kind of, when we came out, he would kind of take us under his wing and, you know, show us around.
What a sweetheart.
Help us out.
He was a real
gentleman. Yeah. They have a shrine for him out at Montauk over by Turtle Cove.
I haven't seen it yet.
It's still there, yeah. Oh,
yeah,
sure.
Yeah. So memories, wow.
Yeah,
and that's what the baits and lures also bring up, right, in a sense? The memories, the history?
It's the history. It's the innovation. It's looking at what they did, and to tell you the truth, being a fisherman, I appreciate the ones that are the hardest to find, because those are the ones that usually caught fish, so it's hard to find them in good condition.
Mm.
You find them and they're all the paint's gone, and you know that it caught a lot of fish. So those are the ones that interest me the most.
And what's the oldest in your collection?
Well, it's kind of hard to document the date. I would say probably 1945, but I have one that I just picked up this year that was wrapped in a July 11th, 1947 piece of paper from the Philadelphia Inquirer in the box. So I was born in 1947, so it kind of caught my attention.
I would think.
It was about 2 months after I was born. So I would say 1945 is probably the beginning of it.
And are these fishing lures for people who fish generally? Are they the ones who are more interested in collecting? But because, you know, I was telling you about a friend of mine who has a fishing lure and he hangs on the Christmas tree during the holidays. But, I mean, he just collected because he loved it.
It's kind of a mixed crowd. And the ones of us who are fishermen, we kind of belittle the ones that don't fish.
Oh, okay.
And we kind of make fun of them to their faces. There are some guys that are quite serious and have quite nice collections that don't fish at all.
Mm.
They're just into it for the love of the history and or for whatever.
But the people who come and see, say, the decoys, Bob, and Bob Jones for the fishing lures and baits, I mean, are these people who generally have a tie to the sport, or are they just people who like or appreciate art or artistic quality?
People who appreciate the art, I would say, and they come in and just view the decoys. And when you attend a show and you're always looking for someone to come in saying, I have some decoys at home.
Right, Bob? Yes.
Have you had that? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So
and have you acquired from that?
Yes. Quite often. Yes.
Have you gotten good bargains?
Absolutely.
So like, if anybody has something up in their attic,
uh-huh,
that is a decoy or a shorebird or a decoy or a baits and lures sitting around in their attic, they should bring it.
And then is it like Antiques Roadshow? You can kind of assess the value of one as you look at it?
Yes.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Yeah, I'll do that for sure.
What's the most expensive decoy that you've ever purchased, Bob Lear?
I can't.
You don't know?
I cannot reveal that.
You
I'm
cannot
sorry.
Reveal
no.
it.
No.
Wow.
Good man.
Good man.
Now,
wait, Bob Jones. Same question to you.
I may want to sell it
one
day.
I may want to sell it, right.
I'll put it to you this way. I realized I was a collector when I paid over $500 for a lure.
A lure. What is the allure they
go,
of lures?
They can go even higher than that, but we're not going to get into numbers here.
Oh, we're not, huh? Who says? This is my show. No, I'm just kidding. But so describe, people think of decoys, and this is always great visuals for radio, right? But it's a challenge to describe like one of the more interesting decoys that you're going to show in the show this weekend.
I have a collection of Eugene Cuffey decoys. He was a carver from the Shinnecock Indian Reservation. He lived from 1867 to 1941, so a good amount of his work was done around the turn of the century. He did take some of his birds and works to Abercrombie & Fitch, which sold them out of New York as well as Chicago. So it's not unusual to find some of Eugene Cuffee's birds around the country.
Wow. Are these all on stands, Bob?
Yes. They have stick holes in them, so you mount them on a stick on a little stand and display them.
And are they very lifelike?
Oh, yes, yes. And often what's appreciated is the patina of the paint that was done. And if you put them under a strong light, you can actually see a lot of the colors and details.
Mm.
I just find it amazing that such detail went into making a decoy or bird at that time.
And it used to be all wood, right? They used to carve.
Yes. Yeah, carved the wood, right? And then painted the decoys. And they put such detail into it at that time. And if you can imagine, probably painting one of these decoys, it was probably done out in the daylight or under a candle or a lantern.
And yet they captured the detail.
Yes.
Yeah, I was just at Morton Wildlife Refuge in Noyak. Have you guys been where you can feed the birds from your hand?
Yes.
And turkeys came up, and I fed turkeys from my hand. You ever have a turkey, like, wallop you with his beak in the middle of your palm? That's quite an experience. But, I mean, seeing, you know, so I don't know if you have turkey decoys. I don't know that anybody would have built something like that. You know, turkeys, you don't need that, right? They just walk in front of you. But the detail of the feathers, they're, like, almost iridescent. I mean, are there some carvers that could capture that as well?
Oh, yes.
Oh, it's phenomenal to be able to capture what nature does. Now, how about in lures, in building lures? I mean, what does it take to make a good lure?
Well, my favorite builder by far is a guy named Charlie Russo, who was from the Lower East Side of New York. He had... Chaz Russo was his first company. Russo Bait Company was his second company. Osur, which is Russo spelled backwards, O-S-S-U-R, was his third. And then his last, the last one that I'm aware of was Snook Bait Company. And just the colors and the, they all caught fish. They all caught fish. I mean, you find his lures just completely annihilated. And you know that they caught a lot of fish. And
does that make a lure more valuable? The more annihilated it is.
They're hard to find. They're hard to find in good condition, and even harder to find than the lures are the boxes that they came in, because most of the guys that fish them would give the box to their son, or throw it out, put it in a garage, keep nails in it. So the boxes are even harder to find than the lures sometimes. And sometimes the boxes are more valuable than the lures.
Really, yeah.
So for me to find a mint Charles Russo box is a real coup. So,
do you ever see any lures or decoys at the Antiques Roadshow on that show or that kind of show? I don't think I remember seeing any of those pop up.
No, I haven't.
Because I'd be curious at the value of these, you know? The value
keeps coming back. How much are these?
Yeah, I'm just curious. I
maybe
mean,
you'll
we
sell
all?
That one that normally gets hung on the Christmas tree.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I don't even know how old it is, but it looks to be like maybe 50, 60 years old. But it still is very colorful, so I guess it didn't catch many
fish.
Does
it have a flap tail on the back?
Yeah.
It does.
Yeah.
That's from the era. That's what they did back then.
Uh-huh. Oh, my God. So people can, if they've got lures and decoys, they can come by and bring them and show them to you, right?
Yes.
Okay, so you'll appraise them if you
want? Oh, absolutely.
Yeah?
Absolutely. Bring them in. Bring them in, and I'll make them a very generous offer.
An offer they can't refuse. Yeah, well, how many will you have on view of your lures and baits, Bob?
I have over 100. Last year I had over 100. This year I probably have two more cabinets, so maybe 120 pieces I'll be bringing.
And they will be in within the museum, right,
yes,
Anne?
Within the whole museum, the main floor, which is, by the way, accessible to everyone, is going to be set up, and Bob Lear is going to have his boat there. He does a great exhibit, so the whole floor. And it's free, open to the public and free, and we ask for a suggested donation, which all goes to the restoration fund, which allows our museum to be secure and safe in the present and into the future.
Nice. And people can find out more online, right?
They can. They can go to watermillmuseum.org and get information, or they can email me at director@watermillmuseum.org.
And is it 11 to 5 all 3 days?
Yes, all 3 days, 11 to 5.
How many decoys will you have on view, Bob?
Possibly 40 to 50.
40 to 50. Think, yes. Nice. What's the biggest one?
I have a large heron done by Eugene Cuffey. There's only four known to exist. One's in the Shelbourne Museum.
Oh, my God.
The other's in the Stony Brook Museum. The other's privately owned, and I have the fourth.
You have the fourth.
Yes.
Is it a great blue?
Yes.
A great blue?
It
so it's life size?
Oh, it stands about 3 foot high.
Mm. Unbelievable. I got to come see this. I got to come see this, yeah.
Probably stood out in someone's garden for years.
Right? Beautiful. Bob Lear, Bob Jones, thank you both. And Lombardo, thank you as always.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Thanks to WPBB.
Thank you so much. And watermillmuseum.org is the way to find out more. 3 days free. It's the vintage New York Saltwater Fishing Baits and Lures Show and the Antique Working Decoy Collectibles Show at the Watermill Museum this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Stay tuned. We're going to explore more of the harvest on the East End here on WPPB. And brown. Make a batch of buttermilk, cold cakes, brown mine, chicken thighs, and you chomp on down, singing any fish bites if you got a good day. Here's a little tip that I would like to convey. Any fish bites if you got a good day. I'm on fishing, and it's all fishing, and my baby on fishing, too. Play the blues.
Support for WPPB comes from Daymark's Market, 3 Mile Harbor Road in Springs. Established in 1949, Daymark's features a variety of breakfast, lunch, and dinner items, from pastries to omelets, sandwiches, a selection of hot foods and gourmet specialties, a yogurt salad bar, an ice cream counter, homemade desserts, and more. Daily menu information is available at 631-324-0691 or online at daymarksmarket.com.
Support for WPPB comes from the West Hampton Beach Performing Arts Center, presenting two great American comic storytellers. Sunday, October 7th, the legendary Bill Cosby shares stories and observations on life. Then on Friday, October 19th, best-selling author and humorist David Sedaris reads excerpts from his absurd writings regarding today's culture. Information is available at whbpac.org or 631-288-1500.
Hello, everyone. This is Christiana McMahon, your psychic and medium. Tune into my show every Tuesday at 5:30 p.m. We're airing live, ready to take you on an intuitive journey, answering all your questions, giving you a spiritual spin on all matters. I encourage everyone to listen to your heart and see with your spirit. So please join me, call in at 1-800-394-8830 on 88.3 Peconic Public Broadcasting.
Support for WPPB comes from Bridgehampton National Bank, committed to helping local businesses stay on top of their competitive challenges. With long-term relationships, local decision-making, and an understanding of the marketplace, BNB community lenders and branch managers help their customers succeed every day. Many success stories, one bank, Bridgehampton National Bank. Information is available at bridgenb.com.
This is John Landis inviting you to join us at the Jam Session every Wednesday night at 7 here on WPPB 88.3 FM. The Jam Session is recorded live each Thursday night from 7 to 9 at Bayburger in Sag Harbor at 1742 Sag Harbor Turnpike. So come out, join us at Bayburger on Thursday nights and right here on PPB 88.3 FM every Wednesday night at 7 for the Jam Session. Live jazz from the East End of Long Island.
Everything you hear on WPPB is made possible by listeners like you. If you enjoy Eclectic Cafe, Afternoon Ramble, Friday Night Soul, or any of WPPB's programs, please make a contribution today. Shows like these would not be possible without your support. You do make it happen. As an independent public radio voice, we need you now more than ever. Go online at peconicpublicbroadcasting.org or call 631-591-7003.
You're listening to Conversations at the Cafe on 88.3 FM, Peconic Public Broadcasting. Say hello.
like children sleeping, we could dream this night away. But there's a full moon rising, let's go dancing.
This is Cassandra Wilson's version of Harvest Moon by Neil Young. And for you this morning on Conversations at the Cafe, the Eclectic Cafe on WPPB, good morning. I'm Bonnie Grice, here with engineer Kyle Lynch. Harvest East End took place on Saturday, August 25th, and this year at a new venue, the Hampton Classic. And for the hundreds of you who attended, you sampled the bounty of 40 East End wineries and more than 30 top regional chefs and more than 200 Long Island wines. This year's Harvest was a huge success, helping to raise more than $42,000 for three of our important local charities, East End Hospice, Peconic Land Trust, and Group for the East End. But the harvest continues, certainly in the fields and across the East End with the 10 Mile Dinner Series. It's a series of invitation-only vintner dinners which take place in private East End homes with all wines and food courses sourced from within 10 miles of the diners' plates. Each of the charities receive all of the proceeds from these private dinners. Joining us live on the line are two of the folks involved in two separate dinners, and they include our good friend, he is winemaker extraordinaire Roman Roth. Roman, good morning.
Good morning, Bonnie.
Are we talking to you from the field, from the vines?
Well, I was pressing grapes till 4:30 this morning, though last night, I should say. So the harvest is on for sure.
It's on for sure. Joining us also is winemaker and rancher Russell McCall. Russell, good morning.
Morning, Bonnie.
How are you?
I'm great.
Yes. Are you out in the fields too?
No, I think Roman works harder than I do.
You are from, obviously, from McCall Wines, which is based in Cutchogue, and I find it very interesting. Talk a little bit about McCall's history. It's a fairly new part of the Long Island wine scene, right, Russ?
Yes, that's correct. We planted our vineyard back in 1997, but I got into it a little bit sideways because there was a 100-acre piece of property on the North Fork where the Courtauld Indian tribe used to live, and the town and the people wanted to preserve it from development. So my family and I contributed and purchased the farmland. I'd been in the wine business all my life, so I ended up saving the property from development and then planting a vineyard because it was the field that I was familiar with.
Hmm. Now, you also own a ranch?
Well, it's more than just a, yes, it's more than just a vineyard. We also have a cattle ranch that's in the same place, and we grow and breed a Charolais beef, which is a white cow that's very dominant in France and Central Europe.
Hmm. So we actually have a beef cattle ranch on the east end of Long Island?
Right, and we sell at the local restaurants. The main restaurant we sell is the famous North Fork Table and Inn, and they carry our beef. It's organically raised. We don't feed any chemicals or any hormones or antibiotic shots. It's so the cattle are as pure as possible, and they're grown here, harvested, and consumed here on the North Fork.
Wow, very impressive. Roman, I wonder, how has the yield been this year? How is the harvest?
So far, it's a dream, knock on wood. If we get a little lucky and we won't get too much rain today. I mean, everybody has seen the last 10 days of pure sunshine. It's been a great spring, a great summer. And if we're a little lucky with a great fall, this could be a special year.
Could it be a banner year, you think?
It could be very special, but knock on wood.
Yeah, we don't want to jinx it at this point.
Exactly.
But, I mean, do the grapes like dry and warm?
Yes, because at this stage, you're really trying to concentrate the fruit. You want that there is no more dilution with lots of rain. And so it's, you know, keeps fungus pressure low if there's no rain. And already we had a great start, so the stage is set for something spectacular, but you have to be lucky. It's, as they say, the last inning that counts. And if we're a little lucky, we bring back, it's already a good vintage or a great vintage, but, you know, now, of course, hopes are high and we want to make it a fantastic vintage.
Yeah, sure. And what will you be serving at your 10-mile dinner this weekend, Roman?
At our 10-mile dinner, we have a fantastic lineup, of course, with Kurt Guttenbrunner from the great restaurants, Austrian chef. He's one of the top chefs in the U.S., and we have a whole lineup from the wines. We start off, of course, with sparkling wine. You want to make it festive. We have the Wolfel sparkling wine 2008, the Blanc de Blanc, that goes with canapés, with different tastes. Then there will be, with the first sit-down course, there will be, which is an interesting dish. It's marinated fluke and sweet and sour pumpkin. So I felt we make use more of one of our more aromatic wines, which is the classic white, which has Gewürztraminer, Riesling, and Chardonnay. It's a blend. So that should be quite versatile, that wine, and should stand up to those flavors. Followed up by the classic, Long Island striped bass with our Pearl Chardonnay, which is the top of the line Chardonnay we make. Our White Horse wine, and it's one of, they all my children, but the Pearl is a special wine.
Why is it so special?
Well, we have a beautiful clone. They're smaller clusters, so every berry is exposed to sunlight and ripens very homogeneously, and so you can really pick an ideal picking moment when all the grapes are ripe. And as a result, because also our Sea Breeze, where you have a freshness. So we don't make these fat, flabby Chardonnays. We make these vibrant, elegant Chardonnays. And this is sort of the most concentrated, the most intense version of all of this, what I just said. So this is special wine.
You've got to work hand in hand in putting these dinners together, I would think. And Russell, you as well, you're going to be working with James Beard, award-winning chef Peter Burley, right?
Right, that's correct. Yeah, we actually have a meeting this afternoon set up to determine the menu, and this dinner is being put on by the Taconic Land Trust. So, you didn't mention, but the proceeds of the dinner go 100% to the charity.
Yes, right.
So each of us that donates the wine donates 100% of the wine and our time. The chef donates his time. And then the people that come, everything that they pay and the wonderful evening they have, the funds that are raised go entirely to the charities that you mentioned.
Right, right. Peconic Land Trust for you. And you have, obviously, a very special connection with them. Right, Russ?
Yes, I do. It's been one of my favorite charities for many years, and I've worked very closely with them. I think what they've done to preserve property on the North and South Fork of Long Island is just spectacular. I mean, we would be in a much worse position if they hadn't been nurturing this process along the way. So I'm happy to donate. We're going to be serving, we have a large Pinot Noir vineyard, and we have a rosé of Pinot Noir from 2011 that's very fresh and lively. And then when we get into the more serious wines, we have a sort of a late picked Sauvignon Blanc. It has a kind of a melony flavor. It's very similar to French Sancerre.
And, oh, I love Sancerre. So, wow. Yeah.
And then we have some red wines. We have a Bordeaux blend we call Ben's Blend from 2007, and a reserve Pinot Noir that's also from 2007 that will go with the final courses.
Now, Roman, you obviously have been involved with, you are, you know, one of the chair people, one of the founders of the Harvest East End event, and these 10-mile dinners. I mean, whose idea was it to kind of stretch the harvest beyond the big gala?
Well, there's two reasons. One was we felt, well, Long Island, every great wine region has a great wine festival, and Harvest East End is certainly the one for Long Island. But we didn't want to just stop there. We felt the wines that the wineries make on Long Island, and the best wines from Long Island, they belong to the best, onto the best tables that New York has to offer, or the world for that matter. And so we felt by doing these 10-mile dinners in these most spectacular homes, in these wonderful places, ours is at Carolyn Rockefeller's place, which is a beautiful place in Southampton, and everybody's, or Russ's dinner, they're all these wonderful places, and that's where Long Island wine belongs, on these tables. It's for the use, it's for the enjoyment of food, wine, and be proud of what this region can produce. And that's where this was extended to these 10-mile dinners.
And I love the idea. The idea is that all of what you consume comes from within 10 miles of where you're eating, right?
That's right, because we're very proud of what local and what a lucky region we have with the farms, with the fish, with, you know, Rusk raising cattle, and there is bison and a couple of different dishes and ducks, of course. So it's a, you know, it doesn't get much better to have a great plate, a great dinner. Everything is right there for the grab.
Wow. So, okay, Roman had a chance to describe what he's serving. Russ, why don't you weigh in on what your chef, Peter Burley, is going to be making?
Well, Peter and I have been going back and forth, but we haven't made a decision, and that's why we're meeting this afternoon to put the final touches on it. But last year I had an interesting dinner. We've done this for a few years now, and this is the members of the Long Island Merlot Alliance that get together with a chef, and now 3 years in a row, we've really seen a lot of people and talked to a lot of chefs and had a great, great response. So that's why we continue with it. But last year, Christian Meir, who's the chef at the Stone Creek Inn in Quad, cooked a side of Charolais cattle and made three different dishes. I mean, these chefs, it's wonderful dealing with them because they come up with such inventive ideas. And I haven't had one yet that wasn't spectacular. So anyone that wants to sign up in the future for a 10-mile dinner is bound to be rewarded.
Yeah, you're probably always looking ahead to that, right, Roman? Looking ahead to the next one and having chefs sign up for next year?
Well, it's already in the works. Donnell Brown is our events coordinator, and literally pulls it all together. So it's great that the Merlot Alliance is basically the underwriter, the force behind it, and the Wine Council, of course, is involved. And we really have to thank to these great charities, which is the Peconic Land Trust, the East End Hospice, and the Group for the East End. Those, without these three amazing partnerships with these five different groups that have come together and really represent everything that's on the East End. And I think that has come together to raise money for these great causes for our land, our people, and the environment. And then so you're starting already to work on next year's event, and that's what makes, of course, a great event that you just come in May up and say, oh, let's do something. It's already in the works.
I'll leave it to Donnell for sure.
She's fantastic.
I love, Russ, that your dinner is going to be not at a private home, but at Bridge Gardens Trust.
Right, exactly. We're an insurance company out in the Hamptons decided that for their own, I suppose for their employees and their best customers, they would buy the entire dinner out. And they think that the Peconic Land Trust is a great charity, so they just decided to take the whole thing. So, we'll be out there, and I'm sure it'll be a wonderful time.
Does that mean you're going to be serving a lot more than the other private dinners because you have a bigger space to fill?
Well, it's possible that we'll have. It's up to the chef. We always let the chef determine what he thinks the local produce and the local food products he can find that he wants to deal with. And then what we in the wine side try to do is to pair whatever wines we have as perfectly as possible with each dish. So I think it's certainly going to be a beautiful menu. I'm looking forward to it.
Now, Russ, you're the president of the Merlot Alliance, yes?
Yes.
What does that entail?
Well, that entails we have a group of members, and we kind of go different person every couple of years. Mostly it entails being an advocate for high-quality wines. On the South Fork, you all have known Wolfer for a long time. I'm relatively new on the North Fork. But those of us in the Merlot Alliance have sort of come together because we make Merlot and Merlot-based wines, and also we've come together because we're great believers in taking the time and energy and putting our resources into making the absolute best possible quality wines. So this is an organization that's based primarily on high quality, and that's why we're very comfortable showing them off at events like the 10 Mile Dinners.
Yeah, And Roman, you and Russ must get together all the time and talk instead of talk turkey, you talk Merlot, I guess, or something, right?
Well, it's nice that, you know, if you don't like people, don't go into the wine business. And that's what's nice with these get-togethers and dinners. And, you know, you don't really get tired of it. You enjoy it. And every time you come home with either a new idea or a great conversation and a nice meal and a nice tasting, then you grow your horizon and get better what you do.
How much of, you know, I was just thinking about this. It's true in politics, I think, too, but how I was watching an interview the other night. How much of all of this is the social aspect of it? You know, the gathering together for the wine and for these dinners. And how much of it, how much is driven by that side of it? Roman?
Well, I think as long as you have a good foundation and the social aspect doesn't interfere with your daily life, it is fantastic, and it's a great lifestyle. It is fun. There are the seasons that are changing. You know, you have the hard work at harvest time. You have a lot of socializing in the summer. You have quiet moments in the cellar in the winter where you make the wines, and that's so you have to be just, you have to find the balance in life, if we only always would find it.
Yeah, right. Are you finding it now, or is this a real heated time? It's got to be for both of you, right, Russ?
Yeah, it's difficult. I spent 4 days last week out in the field picking from early in the morning until late at night our Pinot Noir. It normally ripens early. And then later in October, we have Cabernet Franc, Merlot, and some Cabernet Sauvignon. But yeah, I think I agree what Roman says. We do spend a lot of time socializing. But, you know, if you're very proud of your wine and you have your name on it, or you have the name of the owner, and it carries a lot of responsibility, and you want to be with customers, get their reaction, see what they think. And it's fun to be out there doing that if you're really proud of what you've done. So it's not a burden at all for me. I'm thrilled with the social side.
How much can you both drink and still stand up? I'm just curious.
Two glasses a day, and the rest we don't count.
Yeah, the rest you don't count. Okay. Russ?
Yeah, well, I've been in the wine business. Before I was in the vineyard business, I had a distributing company in Atlanta, Georgia. So I've been in the wine business since I was in my 20s. And, I'm comfortable around wine and trying different things. Most of the time, I don't really ever overdo it and just taste things. And if I don't think it's a wonderful thing, I just spit it out. Mm. You know, I mean, it's common to try things, but when you get some of the, we're really making some beautiful wines. We had people in our tasting room this week that said, we just can't believe how the wines on Long Island have matured and how the quality is. And at many, many vineyards, they stop and they just say, well, this is great. We're
this
thrilled.
Is great.
So, I enjoy having a glass of wine with those people.
That's great.
But the good producers also, they don't make quaffing wine. Yeah, you make wines that you want to savor, that you want to smell, that you enjoy slowly, and it's not gulping stuff what
right.
you produce.
Well, thank you both for talking with us. And we'll see you Saturday, Roman. Roman Roth and Russell McCall. Thanks to you both.
Thanks very
okay,
much.
All right. Have a great time at your dinners. And the BBC News is next.